History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And thankfully, they don't have to go untold, as long as some of us are willing to take just a couple simple steps. First, take the initiative to ask a few questions. And second, be willing to listen patiently as stories from long ago take on new life in the here and now. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to meet a very special member of that generation today, and you'll have the chance to meet him next month when he turns 100 years old during the Central Coast Air Fest in Santa Maria, California. That two-day air show is going to feature everything from World War II fighter planes to the latest F-35s. Even the Canadian Snowbirds are scheduled to perform. You can learn more at CentralCoastAirFest.com, and I have that linked for you at HometownHeroesRadio.com. But nobody's going to have a better time at that air show than Jim Kunkel of Santa Ynez, California, a recipient of the Distinguished Service Cross for his actions as a P-38 Lightning pilot during World War II. His citation recognizes extraordinary heroism in action against the enemy near Aachen, Germany, 16 September 1944. While flying as rear man in a squadron of an armed reconnaissance mission, Lieutenant Kunkel noticed that his squadron was about to be surprised by a vastly superior force of enemy aircraft. Unable to summon his leader on the radio, he alone unhesitatingly pulled away from his formation and vigorously attacked the enemy, immediately destroying one of his aircraft. In doing so, Lieutenant Kunkel placed himself in a position to be attacked from the rear and above. When this attack materialized, many hits were registered on his aircraft, which caught fire, burning his face, neck, and hands. Despite his burning plane and the gunfire from enemy planes, Lieutenant Kunkel continued his attack against the vastly superior enemy force and succeeded in destroying a second enemy aircraft, breaking off combat only when forced to parachute to safety when his left fuel tank exploded. The heroism and aggressiveness displayed by Lieutenant Kunkel on this occasion reflect the highest credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States. So eventually, we're going to hear the story of that final mission for Jim Kunkel, but it always helps to put everything in context when we start at the beginning. And even though you've spent most of your life here in California, Jim, you're originally from Pennsylvania, right?
New Kensington, Pennsylvania. My dad was in the steel business. In 1932, he passed away. I was 9 years old. And before that, while we had been planning for him to retire, he was injured in World War I. And his great dream was to be an aviator in World War I. Unfortunately, he had this injury, and that was the end of that. But he passed away in 1932. My mother asked me if I wanted to go to California because we've been planning it. And so my mother took some driving lessons, and we came out 66. And the story is that she prayed her whole way to the California, and I pushed. So.
Well, and you're chuckling about it now, but I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. And boy, I mean, that sounds a little eye-opening and intimidating. And I'm curious about your father. You said he was injured in World War I.
Yes.
Is that something he told you about, what happened and everything?
I don't remember all the facts. He was injured on post, and it involved a Baldy rifle. And being a member of the National Rifle Association, I knew that we had some Baldy rifles. And he was in the hospital for quite a long time. So that was about the extent of it. He ended up with what they called an enlarging heart, which today they would think nothing of handling. But we were ready to leave for California, and he had a problem, and he went to the hospital in New York and never came back. So My mother was a goer. I mean, so it didn't slow her up too much. So we came to California for a year and then had to go back to Pennsylvania to settle the estate because my grandfather had died within 6 months of my dad. And so in the meantime, we spent a year in South Carolina, Spartanburg, South Carolina, and my mother had a business down there, and I got malaria, and they said to take me out of South Carolina. So we went back to Pennsylvania and then came to 1936. We came to California to stay.
You know, I'm thinking you beat a lot of odds in the mission where you earned the Distinguished Service Cross, but it sounds like you were dealing with some heavy stuff for your whole life before that. And I'm just interested because it affects everybody differently. But losing your father at such a young age, what was the impact of that on you?
I don't know that there was an impact. I know I missed my dad tremendously. He had instilled aviation in my thinking. Their steel company was a smaller company, and they did what they called electro castings. And a lot of those castings went into the aviation. And I remember we were up at Curtis Wright several times. I went through the Ford plant when I was 7 years old, where they were building trimotor Fords, and have photographs that were taken at that time. So when we came to California, my mother was very good about taking me. She'd take me out to the airport, and I visited every airport in Southern California and used to spend my weekends Saturday and sometimes even Sunday at Grand Central Air Terminal, working in anything you could do, wash airplanes, maybe get 10 minutes flying time, and that sort of thing. So we did a lot of that.
Well, and most guys that I have the privilege of meeting who've been involved in aviation as long as you have seem to have a place where it started, and you've talked about your father passing that on to you, that love of aviation. But do you remember the first time that you got to get off the ground and get in the air?
I think I was pretty young. We'd go someplace, and if there was an airplane close by that my dad could rent for a few days, including the pilot, he did not fly, we'd be up riding around in it. And I think, if I remember correctly, it was an early Travel Air. Probably one of the real early ones was my first flight. And then it was a number of flights and Travel Airs and Walkos and Stinsons. And so we had a home, we lived in New Kensington, but we had a home up in Bedford, Pennsylvania, summer home. So there was a little airport there that was pretty active and still is to this day. They had an enormous hotel there called Bedford Springs Hotel, and that attracted a lot of people. And so whoever the operator was at Bedford in those early days, he did pretty well.
Well, and you know a little bit about how that all works in that world. So you come out here as a child, you spend your teenage years in Southern California. Were you thinking all that time that flying is what you're going to do for your life, or what were your ideas?
I wanted to join the Air Force. I wanted to be a fighter pilot. We had an early friend by the name of Kelly, which happens to be my middle name. This was in Pennsylvania, and so he was a fighter pilot, and unfortunately he was killed in like 1931. But I had made up my mind that's the course I wanted to go. I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. Through all my schooling, that's where I was going. Well, the war interfered with that, and that was the end of it, really. I found out that I didn't want to work on a drafting table.
What you ended up doing was a little more dangerous, but you mentioned the war started. Do you have a memory of that day, December 7th, 1941?
I had a great big horse, and I'll go back another step before that. I was going to Beverly Hill High School in 1939. Of course, the war started in September, right at the beginning of the school year. So I went out at Grand Central Air Terminal. I'd met a number of people. The National Guard, the Air National Guard at that time, had a airfield in Griffith Park, directly across the river from Grand Central Air Terminal, which of course was a major terminal for Los Angeles in those days. I met this gentleman, and he was All-American at SC, and he was a brand new second lieutenant in the Air Guard, and he was working for Al Manasco, who owned Manasco Engines there in Glendale. He said, well, if you're so interested in aviation, why don't you come over to the Guard? We said, we got lots of openings over there. Of course, this was 1939, and I guess they weren't recruiting as easily as they did later. But so I joined the Air Guard, and I stayed with them up until the time I graduated from high school that summer of 1940. We were on maneuvers in Chehalis, Washington, 115th Observation Squadron. So the 115th is still part of the California Air National Guard. The Guard was interesting. I got some pretty nice flying from the back seat. And we had Douglas O-38s that were built in the early 30s. You know, we were really up to date. And we had a couple of O-47s, which were brand new from North American. They were had 1,000 horsepower and carried three people and weren't much good other than that. But that was my high school. I missed my prom. Actually missed my graduation at high school because we were on a field trip. But it was aviation, and that's where I was going to be.
One little side question here, because, you know, you talk about Beverly Hills High School, and people think of, you know, hoity-toity Los Angeles and Hollywood at the time and all that. Can you compare what Los Angeles was like in those days compared to what it's like now? I mean, would you run into movie stars on the street? Was that a big deal like it is now?
Yeah, you'd see them. That held true up through even after the war. Beverly Hills, you know, I've always said I know what it's like to be a minority because I didn't have a chauffeur drop me off at school. I took the streetcar. But other than that, Jackie Cooper was one of my classmates at Beverly Hills. Probably my best friend, who was Hank King, Henry King, and his dad was Henry King that made 12 O'Clock High and all of those motion pictures. And so I was on the fringe of the movie industry, but never had any desire to be involved in it in any way.
You had higher aspirations, no pun intended. So you're in the Guard. And you said you missed your prom and your graduation because of those requirements. So what about that Sunday morning? You said you were riding horses December 7th?
I had a big jumping horse, and I kept it at Dubrock Stables, which was at the corner of Los Feliz Boulevard and Riverside Drive. And there's a big fountain there now that they built. And I kept my horse there, and I met my future wife there when she was like 15. We were riding early in Griffith Park, and a guy who was some kind of a celebrity, was a singer, Johnny Johnson, came by and said, "Did you hear about Pearl Harbor?" So he was the one that told us. And of course, my first thought was, well, I had been released from the Air Guard because when they federalized the Guard, which they did in September 40, when we came back from the maneuvers in Washington, I wasn't 18 yet. So when they federalized, I couldn't go without my mother's permission. And she said, "Nope, you're going to finish your college and finish school and finish the college. And then if you want to be a fighter pilot, why, do it the right way." Then jump back in. And then the war started in Europe. I had some experience with the Guard. When the war started, you know, Pearl Harbor, the big deal was that they dropped the requirement of the 2 years of college, and they dropped the age limit to 18. So me and along with 500,000 other youngsters all ran down and joined up. We all wanted to be fighter pilots. So that's how that ended. But when I was in college, I started early. I went to a school called Cumnock for a short time, then went on to junior college. I decided that the summer of 1941, I worked at North American Aviation all of the summer. I got that job through the Air National Guard because some of our pilots were involved with North American. So I worked all that summer, and when school started, North American didn't have a graveyard shift, which I required. So I went to Lockheed, worked at 7th and Santa Fe downtown Los Angeles, where we built the wings and the empennage and the booms for the P-38 and the Hudson bomber. Go to work at 12 o'clock, be off at 7, and I'd be in school at 8:30. So it was a good active schedule.
Yeah, and maybe that explains why you're still in such great shape and so active. I don't think you ever slowed down. Maybe that's part of it. So you were building P-38s before you flew P-38s. You probably knew what a P-38 was before most people did, too. Was it love at first sight with that airplane?
Well, it was. We had several close friends who were engineers at Lockheed, so I knew about the airplane. And then working around Grand Central, we talked about celebrities. We had a number of them that flew, Robert Taylor, and gosh, I could probably name 10 or 12. Wallace Berry. I got a couple rides with him. He seemed to be a real nice guy. I knew several of the Lockheed test pilots even before I went to work for Lockheed. You know, the 38 in its day, you have to stop and remember, talking about the airplane, it was designed in 1937, the starting of the, when Kelly Johnson drew the first line on the paper. That development period took quite a long time. It was peacetime and nobody had any money, and Lockheed was not doing all that well, and so it took a long time to develop the 38. So they first flew it in 39, and then crashed it within a few hours on a cross country to setting a record, which I guess they were very thankful to do. So there was a lot of history behind that, and I kind of lived it. I was part of it. The being involved with Lockheed, I got the opportunity to work in the experimental hangar where they started the first Constellation and where Howard Hughes used to come in regularly. And so you'd see all these people, and it was just part of your life.
Just a couple things that come to mind here. One, I mean, I've heard the stories of how initially the P-38 had the props turning in the same direction and not counter-rotating like the ones you flew in Europe.
And then they found out they had some control problems. So they switched the props and made both of them critical, but we had lots of young guys who wanted to fly it, so there was no problem there.
And is it possible that there were P-38s that you flew in Europe that you had actually helped construct back in Southern California?
No, not in Europe. I flew 38s. I went through cadets. I ended up at Williams Field. Most of the 38 pilots came out of Williams Field. If you were one of the chosen few, we got to fly the 322, which was the P-38 without turbochargers, and the engines were actually, when the Air Force took them back, well, they did change the engine and the rotation of the prop, but we got 10 hours in that airplane before we graduated. So I did fly in airplanes that the first thing I'd do is go look for that tag up in the flap track, and I could tell whether I worked on that airplane or not. And of course, during my time there in the graveyard shift, I was an inspector. We inspected all the wings, and that's how I knew about the tag, and I had to stamp it. So yes, I did get a chance to fly, but they were all old war wearies by that time.
You know, and another thing that I don't want to gloss over or assume one way or another, but I've heard stories from people in Southern California right in the aftermath of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And it sounds like there was a palpable concern there that Los Angeles could be a target, that if you're working in an aircraft factory, that might be a place the Japanese want to hit. Do you remember any of that concern or suspicion?
Oh, yes. I have photographs of the Burbank plant and the camouflage that they did it. And of course, we remembered the Battle of Los Angeles when they turned on all of the searchlights and shut down the plant, and they were firing at something. They didn't have any idea what they were firing at. Probably some poor guy up there that was trying to find an airport. But they claimed they thought that they had Japanese aircraft over the city for a short time, I think. I think it was more panic than anything else. But yeah, we sat in blackout conditions in that plant most of the night. So a little blurb.
I mean, I'm just trying to picture myself in your shoes. That sounds a little scary.
Well, what was more scary, I had a good friend who rode his big stud horse from Texas to California, and he could tell these horror stories along the way. So that's how we spent the night. We weren't worried too much about somebody dropping a bomb.
It's time for our first break, but there's so much more to come with 99-year-old Jim Kunkel of Santa Ynez, California, a member of the Legion of Valor by virtue of the Distinguished Service Cross he earned 78 years ago this week in the skies over Aachen, Germany. You're going to have the chance to meet him at the Central Coast Air Fest in Santa Maria, California, where he'll celebrate his 100th birthday next month. Find more information at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.